You're listening to an episode of the Life Equals Choices, Choices Equal Life podcast with your host, Kim Olver.
This is Kim, and welcome to the 200th episode of Life Equals Choices, Choices Equal Life. If you like today's episode, be sure to leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts and share with your friends on social media. Just don't forget to tag me at Olver International. Today, we'll be continuing our conversation about DEIB, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging, with Counselor Lacey Gluckert. We will be focused on two groups, people who are incarcerated and those with substance use disorder. I met Lacey several years ago when she was becoming faculty for William Glasser International. Lacey Gluckert has been a licensed addiction counselor in North Dakota since 2007. She worked for various state and private agencies until 2013, when she became frustrated with the amount of external control enforced in treatment programming. She then developed a sole practitioner private practice, Choice Recovery Counseling. She completed her CTRT certification in 2014 and then her faculty certification in 2017. Choice Recovery Counseling has provided Lacey the opportunity to teach choice theory and practice reality therapy with clients seeking substance use disorder counseling. In late 2019, Lacey began care coordination for Free Through Recovery, a program funded by the state of North Dakota, which focuses on decreasing recidivism of people with legal and substance or mental health disorders. This encouraged a shift in focus to primarily working with individuals who are or have experienced significant legal issues. Lacey is able to teach choice theory to individuals who are currently incarcerated, as well as utilizing principles of choice theory reality therapy with correctional officers and staff. She continues to facilitate outpatient substance use groups and individual sessions with CTRT as the foundation. Lacey is married and has two daughters, age 9 and 11, who remind her every day that the only person whose behavior she can control is her own. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lacey.
Hey, thanks for asking.
I'm really excited to talk about these two populations who often are one population with two different issues, but I believe that they're left out of the diversity conversation sometimes. But there are certainly stigma and stereotypes and, I dare say, oppression against people who may have substance use disorders or who are coming out of an incarceration. So I would love to talk to you more about your work with these populations. I know you have a group or program in the prison. Could you tell me about that and how it's structured?
It's actually in our local jail, which is a little different than prison. It basically is involved. It's a completely voluntary group that people can come to. So every Tuesday, the correctional officers go in and have people sign up for the group. I started with one men's group and one women's group. It's now grown to two men's group and one women's group. And honestly, we could probably do it all day long up there. People would be coming in and taking the time. But it's completely voluntary, where it doesn't count for credit towards their case. We don't go into their hearings and say, hey, they've been working on this doing really well. Basically, it really plays on the internal control piece of things, a very external control environment. Each group is about 1 hour long. And again, it's open-ended, because with jail systems, people could be there 1 week, people could be there 2 years. It's really just an open-ended thing. It sets the stage really nicely to just bring in education. It's not a process group by any means, but you do see the people that have been there a little bit longer start to process some of the concepts with people that are in or out, or maybe just have one exposure to the concepts.
I like that. I do some consultation for residential programs that are for drug and alcohol substance use. And there is one guy that I trained in choice theory that used to teach them choice theory, but it was one of those groups that wasn't required. It was voluntary. And he always had more people than would fit in the space that he had for that group. There's something to be said. Well, of course, we both as choice theory people know there's a lot to be said for internal motivation, but especially in an environment that is constantly telling people what they have to do, when you offer them something that they can choose, often their natural response is to choose it because it's the one thing that's freely offered. And they think, well, this is different. Let me check this out. It speaks to what the rest of the system could be. I love that.
Yeah, it's been really fun to see when we talk about relationship, especially. I had spent so many years focusing only on substance use disorder treatment or education, but this really opens up my comfort zone to people that are charged with some much different cases, murder, theft, violent crimes. It's not discriminatory to anybody. Anybody can come in and we don't process those past things. We just process the concepts and how they can apply it right now or in the future. It's been really amazing to me to see what just coming in without that agenda, without that checklist of, oh, well, we're going to report this to your attorney or to the courts, that relationship with some people that I would have never met otherwise has really grown and it has really opened my eyes just to being able to bring those concepts to people and to see their buy-in. They'll even say like, oh, well, we look forward to Wednesday mornings. It's been really cool.
I'm sure that's right. You and I both understand the power of choice theory. And I'm almost certain that bringing it into the jail setting had some challenges for you. Can you share what were some of those challenges or even the hardest part of being able to do that?
Just even getting in was a challenge. I approached the sheriff years ago. We have a relatively small town, I would say. And so getting contact wasn't a very difficult part, but ended up having to apply for a behavioral health grant just to get in to have funding because of the time constraints and not being with the jail, just didn't want to pay for something that they really didn't know about. I was able to get some funding from a behavioral health grant from our county. And naturally, our jail system here is run by our sheriff department. And I'm not super familiar with how other jails might feel in terms of their training, but just from my own experiences locally, some of the biggest barriers and challenges have really been with staff, the interruption of their system from maybe some comments of like, oh, is so-and-so coming to group? Oh, they didn't get up last week. Well, if they're going to sleep, they don't get to go. Just a whole different relationship and vibe between correctional officers and myself, which we could say is the role, but I've also met some of the correctional officers who are very invested in people changing or trying to treat them objectively versus what their charges are, what their history is, or what they did 5 years ago to get into jail. So really just the week-to-week resistance that I have felt from some of the staff has been probably some of the most dissuading influence in the whole process. I've been doing this now for about 3 years. And really for the first 2 years, I would walk in and you could see shoulders drop a little bit like, oh, here we go. And it's really shifted. It's amazing how big of a difference one personality can make just in terms of the process of something. But just staying consistent with it and showing up every week, it's really been a pivotal point in the success of it. Other barriers in and of itself, it is just it's an open-ended group. And so there could be people that are there. Oh man, I've had people there for 18 months already. They're waiting their court dates. And then other times there will be people who miss group for 3 or 4 weeks at a time because they're in the hole, or maybe they are released, or maybe they're in there and then they get another warrant from another county. And that's a whole thing too. So just the legal system in and of itself has been kind of a challenge, I guess we could say.
The consistency of it sounds like it's really hard to maintain. And I want to go back to what you said about the correctional officers. I'm always brought back to something that Glasser taught us, which is all behavior is purposeful. So when I think about why would they give you a hard time about what you were doing there, especially if it was helpful, I have two thoughts. I wonder which one you think was more likely. Because one of the things I think is they were probably trying to get you to give up and to go away because this was something they don't believe in. They see it maybe helping people that they're trying to discriminate against, and that didn't feel good to them. Or maybe it's that if they accepted you and they saw the benefits of this, that now they were going to have to change, first of all, which meant if they recognize they need to change, then it means that they weren't being the best person that they could be prior to, and now they have to learn new ways to be better. What would you say would be the most motivating factor?
Both of those are really spot on. I would say that probably the first one a little bit more. Again, why would we step out of our comfort zone unless it becomes uncomfortable, right? And so something changing that process is uncomfortable. And there's a very empowering thing for some people that go into that field that wear a uniform and work with people in striped uniform. There's a very large distinction. There's a power differential. And when I come in and I'm friendly with people and saying hi to the trustees as they're doing their work, following up on things, blurs that power differential a little bit. Just naturally make them comfortable. They're told to be a certain way. And there's a transition that I feel like our recovery community is trying to make by building relationships that maybe in the past were outside of what people thought were traditional relationships with clients or inmates or however you want to put it. I don't refer to them as inmates when I'm there. And that's not the norm. It goes against the norm. It's uncomfortable in general.
Yeah. When I do my choice theory training with the staff at the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, I talk to them about if you have a feeling that there's us and them and you're othering them, you cannot be effective as a helping professional. You need to think that there, but for the grace of God, I go. You're one decision away from being an inmate or from being someone with a substance use disorder. It's just one decision could take you down the same path. So this idea of the power differential, it's not helpful in doing the work that they're trying to do if their goal genuinely is to see some change.
Yeah, and I don't know if change threatens. The thing about jail, it's an interesting thing too. I work very closely with parole and probation. They're just right down the sidewalk from me. We share the same building essentially. And there's been a person, a probation officer that is, I would say, a friend of mine. We've known each other outside of work as well. But he said the other day, you know, I know that you don't like jail, but sometimes that's the only option. And I said, you know, I think you misunderstood my stance on it. I said, I think jail is one of the best opportunities that we have, but we're not utilizing it. Right. And so like going in there, I don't need to be a correctional officer. That's not my goal. That's not my job going in, but it's the setting that is what most people are in there as a correctional officer or what's considered an inmate. But boy, if we could bring these concepts in and have certain people and individuals that are also available outside of the jail, like myself or other people, I think we could really change lives more consistently than what we're already doing. But again, there's such a resistance locally. And again, I can't speak for other jails or correctional institutes. I'm sure there's some that are really pushing it, but our area is really resistant to change. Rocking the boat with some of those changes by giving people opportunities. It's just a little bit too much. And I don't know, I think we're losing people that way.
I do think that there's some people who are really entrenched in the external control way, and they believe that the only way to change people is to hurt them, is to punish them. And if you take away the idea of punishment, I like to think of incarceration as a protective device for the rest of the community when people are dangerous. And it's not meant, in my opinion, to be a punishment. It's meant to provide safety for people who are outside of the prison so that when people inside the prison can become less dangerous, they can be reintegrated into the community. But there would be other people who think that it has to be punishment, and somehow punishing the perpetrator is justice for the victim or for the victim's family members. And I would love to do a study and talk to people who have had whoever the perpetrator was caught and imprisoned or even put to death in some instances, if that made their loss, their trauma any less, if that helped them sleep better at night. I just can't imagine that that's the thing that really made a difference. I think there's a hope that that'll make a difference, but I don't think it does.
What do we do with people who the victim itself, it's considered the state of North Dakota, because somebody was caught with a narcotic substance or paraphernalia or an amount so large that they're charged with distribution, but we don't have anybody specifically that they're distributed to. But now the person is sitting in jail and, like you said, essentially is getting punished. But at the same time, we're taking away, now they're in jail so long that their apartment is gone. All their belongings were stolen while they were in jail. Their employer is in no way, shape, or form going to take them back. Their family isn't calling them much, or they're spending all their money on phone time and food because the person doesn't have much to eat in there. The people at our correctional center get bologna sandwiches once or twice a day, every day. And so at some point, they're just struggling with those things. And so essentially, we punish the person. And ironically, a lot of the people, especially opiate users, alcohol users, a lot of times will say that they get a lot of freedom out of being in jail. freedom from their addiction, freedom from having to find the next dose to figure out where they're going to sleep tonight. But like you said, we're protecting the community essentially, or the victims from certain perpetrators. But a lot of times, especially here, I would say 70% of the population were essentially protecting them from themselves, but at the same time, them not giving them resources how to maintain their own self-care, their own survival when you get out of jail. A huge part of my role is I bring in concepts and I bring in education, but a huge piece is just trying to develop a relationship with a helper so that they know when they do get out, there are people, whether it's me, whether it's somebody else, but they know that there's people in certain roles that are not going to assign that label to them or approach them in that way, that we're invested in trying to help them meet their survival needs so that they can then step up at some of those other higher brain needs. Because really, we can't expect people when they're homeless or jobless to focus on resolving trauma or working on any kind of other things that are, you know, continuing their substance use.
Right. We put them in prison and then we release them and we call it reentry, but we're not doing anything about reintegration. You can reenter society homeless, jobless, and sleep under a bridge somewhere. That's a colleague of mine, Tony Kitchens, who I'd like to introduce you to, might say, to really reintegrate them into the fabric of society. People need a job. They need a place to stay. And they need at least one relationship with another person that genuinely cares about their well-being. That's the bare minimum that a person really needs to be able to survive and reintegrate, not just reenter.
So maybe the challenge in and of itself is to also sustain that, because again, people right. then have that contact point when they get out of jail. So Choice Recovery, now we've been a sole proprietor for a long, long time. And now I've got a full-time peer support specialist, somebody that has lived experience, has been in recovery. I have two individuals, actually one full-time and one part-time. And that's been the future, is trying to then connect people with more quality relationships. I have seen a lot more people continuing to engage even through return to usage, just because they do have that one or two quality relationships of people that are not using external control. We're not punishing. We're not bribing them to come into the office with anything. Just really coming because they know that there's a relationship there that is, it's just open. It's objective.
Yeah. We talked about what was hard about bringing choice theory into the jail. What do you think was the best part or the most well-received aspect of choice theory in this population?
There's actually a whole library of choice theory books in the jail. I pushed for that because I thought, well, here we have a pretty open schedule for people, right? They have lots of time to read. They have lots of time to process things. For the most part, just honestly, the opportunity to talk a little bit. Again, we don't label things as good or bad. We talk about effective or ineffective. So to have some of their choices validated as purposeful, not necessarily positive, but just to get a little bit of validation and understanding, I think has been probably the most well-received piece of it. Again, people that have not just substance use, but theft, domestic violence, murder charges, just to understand that they're not the person that their charge says they are. They need choices based on all these other things, and to help them get a little clarification on that. I see that as a really big positive. And then also every month or two, the jail allows me to bring in donuts or some sort of baked good from a grocery store. On holidays, they let me bring in cookies. One Christmas, I baked a bunch of Christmas goodies and cookies. And there was an individual who had been for 2 years total. But he said, man, you know, this is the first Christmas in 2 years that I've had a Christmas cookie. And it Aww. Just... Yeah, it was heartbreaking, but it was also really an honor to be able to do something like that for somebody. And again, we talk about how their survival need is met in jail, but it's not what they want. They have what they need, they don't have what they want. And so just to give people a little bit higher need fulfillment at times is pretty important. That's been fun, though, to see adults get pretty excited, honestly, about a maple nut Long John here and there, too.
Yeah.
And we always joke about how when donut day comes up, and I don't tell them beforehand because I don't want people coming in there just for that. I want it to be whoever's going to come. We always say next week's going to be full. You guys better sign up on the list because everybody's going to come back for the donuts. And then
too bad. So sad. You don't do it 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah. See everybody come in the next little confused, like, wait a minute. I thought there was something extra.
Yeah. They'll come in drooling. Where's my donut? That's so funny. I am certain that part of what you deal with, you mentioned grant money initially, but I'm sure that there's never enough money and there's never enough time to do what you're trying to do. If this were a perfect place and you got to have all your wishes come true, what do you think this program could look like, given enough time and enough money?
My quality world picture is really that being up at least with group. It could be a daily thing. I would like to be up there 3 whole days a week, being able to meet with people, and then also utilizing my license to work with people, get their chemical dependency evals done and get them into treatment. Basically, just to do what I do on an outpatient basis, but inside the jail would just be really a great opportunity. I would like, if I could control people, which I know I can't, I would love for them to be self-teaching, essentially. And some people, again, it really depends on who ends up there, how long they are there. But there was a woman in a women's group at one point who would ask for some homework, and she would come in the next week and try to teach one of the choice theory concepts, or just even kind of a recovery concept in general. And to me, that was really quality, where then they were working on it together outside of group and they were processing it, and that person was thinking about it, and it really developed some buy-in. Overall, I think it would be really cool to have that, where it's a peer-led choice theory group. I would love for the correctional officers to have read the books also.
Yeah.
Then I would love it if they would ask me to do a little bit of training or education.
Not so far, huh?
No, I will say, as far as financial, that behavioral health grant covered 2 years. And at the end of the second year, the sheriff built in funding for me to continue the group into the biennial budget, basically. So now I'm not getting paid through grant money. I'm getting paid through what is our sheriff's department budget.
That says a lot about how valued what you do is, at least to the sheriff, if not the COs. Choice theory training has been shown to be quite successful in prisons, especially, I'm sure you've seen the work that came out of California in the Corona prison for women out there. The recidivism rate was hugely decreased by choice theory training. I had the pleasure of being there and teaching a choice theory group while I was there. It was incredible. And then I know a woman, Nancy Muir Dees, who used to teach in Oklahoma to a prison that she would go into, and she did work in prison. And I believe Mona Duncan also does work, choice theory work in a prison. And when we were doing our Big Glasser experiment in Corning, New York, we did some work in the prison there. And those are only the ones that I know, but I'm sure that there's many others that maybe people who didn't go on to be trainers, but who just learned choice theory and are using it, I'm sure there's been others. And everyone that I'm aware of had an impact. So I would love to see this be more commonplace in our correctional facilities, if correction truly is the goal.
Absolutely. It really challenges what is success, especially with the substance use field. For so many years, we've had success as this picture of complete abstinence the rest of your life, perfect abstinence. And with jail experiences, success means going out, getting a job, getting a place to live immediately. Part of my goal is for people to start to look at success maybe as a different meaning, that maybe we break it down a little bit more. Maybe success is that when people are out on the street, essentially, or even when they're in jail, they decide not to choose a behavior that is ineffective for them anymore. I had a gentleman about a year and a half ago who came back to group 1 week, and he was so excited and fired up because he made a different choice. He talked about how his power need was really threatened one day because somebody made a comment about, oh, you stole my lunch or something of that effect. And food is a huge thing. That is a real big thing for them. And so somebody had poked at him and he walked away and he went into his cell and he isolated himself for a little bit. For him, that was so far on the other side of the spectrum from what he usually chooses to even out his power need a little bit. And he was so excited. And he said, I think something's changing. I think that maybe I can make changes because I decided not to hit that person in the face. I decided to go into my cell and read a little bit and think about things a little bit. And I realized it wouldn't have any kind of long-term payoff for me. You know, that gentleman got out and he was reincarcerated again at one point for another unrelated charge. It's really easy to look at that and say, well, that wasn't success. He came back to jail. But in that moment, there was a huge success.
That's right.
Can't say as a society, well, you didn't get anything out of that. I mean, maybe we can because we look at that return trip to jail. But for him, that was a really pivotal moment.
They have a phrase in AA I'm sure you're very familiar with, progress, not perfection. And if we're expecting perfection, no program is ever going to create that. No person is going to succeed at perfection. Not you, not me, not an inmate. No one can reach perfection. So if we start measuring, are you a better human today than you were yesterday? That's the progress idea, not comparing to other people, not comparing to other people who've never been incarcerated, but comparing to yourself. Am I better today than I was yesterday? That's a definition of success that I believe that they could measure themselves against. Yeah.
That really defines internal versus external control. Society says you aren't succeeding or this isn't progress, but that does not mean that that has to be your level of comparison or that doesn't have to be your self-evaluation. And again, a lot of people that are in jail have a real long history of trauma related to shoulds and how society sees them and how society is going to see them when they get out. So to give them a little bit more empowerment over that and to give them more choice, regardless of what the circumstances are going to be at some point, it can be pretty empowering and freeing for them.
Yeah, totally. So Lacey, I hate to do this, but we're out of time. So I just wanted to see if there's anything you'd like to add that we didn't get a chance to talk about.
I just appreciate people acknowledging the, like you said, the diverse and the specific population that is experiencing these things. And again, just for anybody moving forward, if you're looking at people that have been incarcerated or are substance using, understand that until we get their survival needs met, we really can't focus on all these higher brain needs. Just because somebody is happy today or they're sober today doesn't mean that we can continue to work on that until they're housed and they're fed and they know where they're going to get their next meal or have a little money. And I know that the program itself isn't taking care of that necessarily, but I think it's kind of opening people's eyes to understanding that to be a bit more giving to people that are in those circumstances.
So Lacey, if people want to reach you to talk about what you're doing or get any information, how could they contact you?
On my website, there's a contact box for www.choicerecoverycounseling.com.
All right, that's great. So Lacey, I cannot tell you how grateful I am for you coming on the podcast. I know you're crazy busy and you managed to squeeze me in. We're doing this on a Sunday. I appreciate that. And I also want to thank you for the soul-sustaining work that you're doing for the clients that you work with. They need somebody to believe in them, and you are providing that for them. And that is amazing work. I really appreciate what you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and remember to leave a review and share with your connections on social media. I also hope you'll join me next week when we'll be continuing the conversation on DEIB with my granddaughter, Sage, a female wrestler. I'm looking forward to it. Talk with you then.
This has been another thought-provoking episode of Life Equals Choices, Choices Equal Life. To listen to past episodes, please visit our website at lifeequalschoices.com or listen wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget, remember to subscribe.